Good morning to everyone. It's great to see you and great to have this beautiful weather. It's cooler today, I understand it, which I love. My wife and I, we have plenty of, 80, 90 degree days back home, and we're good to be here. Let's get right into this after taking another moment to look at my family. Okay. No. Talking about, that's the wrong title. Maybe, let me see. This is the wrong presentation. Let me fix it really quickly. Let's see. Okay, number four, I think, should be, unless I mislabeled it, which I've done before. The David Dynasty. Yes, that's it. Okay. While it's loading, a lot of photos. There we go. Okay, we're going to talk about David and his descendants this morning. David's special because it's King David, but it's also special for another reason in archaeology, which I'll explain in just a moment. That picture, that ruined city, that was where I worked for my first five seasons in archaeology. And I spent a total of about 3 months of my life in that area, that photo, working, helping dig a lot of those things up. And it's given us a lot of knowledge on some things that was lacking before in a very key area. But let's just introduce it like this. Before the Israelites arrived, there were Canaanites in Canaan. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were there, and they interacted with the local people, the Canaanites. And we have ruins, big ruins from that time. Here is a wall built around the time of Jacob, the city of Shechem. And Jacob spent time there. In fact, his sons Simeon and Levi have a very infamous story inside those walls, which we're not going to get into now. Maybe some of you already remember it. But big wall, big stones, big fortifications. You go inside, that was the ruins. These are the ruins of a multi-level temple, which makes an appearance in the story of one of the judges, the bad judge, Abimelech, one of Gideon's sons, who committed a massacre in this temple. A very grotesque one, which the book of Judges describes. And you go down south to the city of Ashkelon, a Philistine city. But Samson hung out there, and look at this massive fortification wall that was constructed before the Israelites ever got there. And Samson likely saw this wall and walked by it. And this is where he killed 30-something Philistines to get their clothes, to settle a bet. That was right inside this wall, or just outside that wall, the entrance. And we have records of diplomatic communications. These are small tablets from Egypt, but they're copies of messages from Pharaoh to different kings up in Canaan, like the king of Jerusalem, the king of Shechem, and other places. And we have all this going on before the Israelites are there. Evidence of big culture and construction and governments and literacy, all these things. And after the time of David, when we had the divided kingdoms of Israel and Judah, we have a lot of similar things. We have this inscription that mentions King Ahab. I think we referenced this in a previous lesson, and it's from Assyria. But we have also this prism talking about King Hezekiah, one of the later kings as well. And we have writing and messages and international relations. And we have this wall up in Samaria, which is what the capital city of the northern kingdom of Israel, where Ahab and other kings reigned from. And they built this wall, big stuff. So we have, there's much more we could talk about. But we have a lot of ruins in Canaan from the time of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the Canaanite ruins. And we have the later divided kingdoms. But the time of Saul and David and Solomon, those early kings, we have almost nothing. There's a gap in the archaeological record between these periods with lots and lots and lots of ruins and discoveries and finds. So the question is, why is there this gap? Why do we have in the time of David and Solomon almost nothing that we can connect with them in any way? And it became a problem, the archaeological problem with David. Why isn't there stuff to find? And that was compounded by when we looked at other cultures like the Egyptians or the Assyrians or Babylon or other places. They mentioned kings like Ahab and Hezekiah, and they mentioned Canaanite kings before David. And, we had mentions of kings and even messages to and from kings before and after David and Solomon, But no one else outside of the Bible ever mentioned David or Solomon. So, like, why does no one talk about them if they were supposed to be these great kings? That compounds the problem. And you add that in archaeology, we don't really find anything in the area of their kingdom, David and Solomon's kingdom. And so where are the city walls they built? Where's the big construction? Solomon built a lot of stuff, they say. Where is it? We can't find traces of it. And, you know, David wrote Psalms, and they have a law, and Solomon has a government, and you have to have literacy, you know, taxing, tax records and messages to other kings and all that stuff. And we don't have many inscriptions, and people are beginning to wonder, could they even read or write their language? We can't find evidence of it like we can in other times. So where's all the missing stuff? Why is there stuff missing? That seems to contradict the Bible. And could the Israelites in David and Solomon's time write stuff down or not? That's pretty important. You know, religious laws and Psalms and all that. And so, you know, that's where setting things up. But then there's another question. Well, we're looking at David's time. What should we expect to find? How much stuff did David build according to what we know? And we know he built around Jerusalem some, but it doesn't really say David built anything else. So maybe are we expecting more than what we actually should? Now, Solomon built a number of things, the Bible describes, so maybe we should look more to Solomon's time for stuff being built. But think about this. Saul, it doesn't say he built anything. But Saul, and really David, they were rulers over a tribal culture, the tribes. And the book of Judges sums up the status of Israel's tribes before Saul and David. There was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So if you're going to build something big, who collects the taxes to pay for it? In a tribal society, there's nobody. Who's going to decide where the borders are and build border fortresses? There isn't anyone. They're tribes. And who is tribes with shepherds and farmers, what big things do they typically build? Like animal pens? You know, there's not much they're probably building in this period. That's part of the reason why they're so weak in the Judges. They're not building cities or fortifying cities. They don't have a government structure to do that sort of thing. There's no central authority. Tribes are governed by their own local elders. And that's really just to solve disputes. They're not really government like we think of it. So maybe we shouldn't expect to find these things in David's time. David ruled over tribes. In fact, it says in 2 Samuel 5, when David's becoming king over all the tribes, who did he have to negotiate with to do that? Because Saul was a king, but he was pretty weak and ineffective. It says in verse 3, all the elders of Israel came to meet with David in Hebron, and he made a covenant with the elders, and they anointed David king. If you want to interact, who do you go through? The local elders. That's not really government. There's no bureaucracy yet. And so it's a tribal society. It takes a while to convert from a tribal society to a society with a strong central government. Doesn't happen overnight. If we look at the Bible carefully, Solomon brings the era of big government to Israel. And that's a different thing. But we probably shouldn't expect to see big signs of government like construction during David's time because he was ruling over a tribal society. And so that makes a difference. Those are questions we need to ask in archaeology. Even with that, even taking that into account, a lot of people back in the 1980s had concluded, a lot of scholars, but we still should find something. Because he was a powerful king, it says, and these records have been doing stuff. We should find something, someone talking about him or something he built, even just to mark his borders or something. And we haven't. And so a lot of people were concluding David was a myth, made up, a legendary figure, perhaps. And with that, the early kingdoms of Israel and Judah didn't exist. There's no evidence for them. Until the 1990s. When we showed this in a previous lesson, we found a monument by a king of Syria that mentions David and his ruling dynasty, the House of David. And this is about 150 years after David's lifetime, not a very long time afterward, really, but they're remembering him, and he has a ruling dynasty several generations in now, and the Syrians talk about him. So they thought he existed. There's someone on the throne. They can trace their ancestry back to David, and they interacted with the Syrians. And so now we have evidence of David. So he's mentioned outside the Bible. Good. But there's also the issue of, well, do we have any archaeology? It says in 2 Samuel 5, when David became king over all Israel, he went and made Jerusalem his new capital. He had to take it from some Canaanites, and he did. And it says in 2 Samuel 5, he lived in the stronghold of Jerusalem and renamed it the City of David. And that circled area is the city, was the city limits at that time. You see modern Jerusalem built up all around it there, but the circle, that's the city David took. Here's more of what it looked like back then. Quite a difference, huh? About, you know, 3,000 years ago versus, you know, now. Here is a picture looking from the same side as this drawing, but today. If you wonder why David chose this spot, look at the distance from the valley to the top of the hill where he reigned. That's pretty defensible. It's easy to protect yourself in that city. And that's no doubt a key reason why David took it. And think about it, the valley is about 25 or 30 feet higher now, the floor of it is, than, or deeper back then than it is now. It's filled in over the centuries. So see where those cars are at the bottom? Drop that another 30 feet, and that's the bottom of the valley in David's time. And David built his palace, it looks like, up in that circled area. So if you're attacking David, David can be up there, you know, looking down, hey, you know, enjoy trying to take my city. You know, it's pretty hard to do. But we dug around that area, and back about 15, maybe 17 years ago, we finally found a building up there that looks like a palace structure. Look at the thickness of that wall. That's not some normal family's home. And it's not a city wall either. City walls, the masonry, the style of the stone is very different. That's a some kind of fortress building, and it dates to around the time of David, its construction. And so the conclusion by most people is that was probably the palace he built for himself. 2 Samuel 5 says he built a palace. And it says people from Phoenicia, like workers, came down from Phoenicia up north where Lebanon is today to build it for him. Why didn't he use Israelite workers to build it? Why did he have to bring them in? Because it's a tribal society. They're not building stuff that big yet. They don't have architectural schools in Israel yet. They're used to building their animal pens. You need someone from a different place that has the know-how to build large buildings that won't collapse and fall in on themselves. So you're importing labor for that, which makes a lot of sense. Tribal society, trying to become an urban society, which they eventually did. But so we have, finally, evidence recently found of David's government, a government building that was probably the palace he built in 2 Samuel 5. Now let's go to my dig site, because I joined this dig in 2009, and I didn't handpick it from all the ones available. I got an invitation unexpectedly, and it turned out to be, of all the digs in all the land and all the world, I lucked into this one. I really did, because this one revolutionized the whole archaeological discussion of David. The palace, okay, but some people were still saying, well, it could have been a Canaanite who built it. You know, David, did he exist? If so, doesn't mean he built that. But now we look out here. This city is important because it's out on the border from Jerusalem, the border with the Philistines. And it was built in the time of David, not before. It wasn't some Canaanite town from Jacob's time. This is built, the dating is David's time. So someone's building this city on the border during the time of David. And the fortifications that survived are massive. Walls are thick and still preserved 8 feet high in some places. They were originally taller than that. The stones, some of them are very large. Some of them are up to 8 tons in size. So that's not something farmers and shepherds just throw together on their free time. This is something that requires serious manpower. And there are a lot of stones. And the walls are what we call casemate walls. Basically, instead of one massive, thick, solid wall, it's like an Oreo wall. You have two thinner walls with space in between. You see the space? Yeah, the outer wall, the inner wall. This is the city wall, but look at that space in between with dividers. It's called a casemate. And it's cheaper and faster to build if you don't have a lot of time or resources. And if the enemy attacks, one section, fill it up with dirt real fast, dirt and rocks. And what's the most important part of the Oreo cookie? You know, the middle. You create this shock absorber between the two walls made of dirt and rocks, and it slows the enemy down. If you survive the assault, you can clear it out, then you have your space back, because the space was used as a room for these houses that were attached to the walls. In fact, that shows the areas we excavated over 7 years. Constructed, the first thing constructed there, and it dates to the time of David, Saul or David. It was destroyed after maybe 25 or 30 years. You don't find much evidence of different phases or renovations. We do have a massive destruction layer, and then it was abandoned. No one rebuilt it. Now, 700 years later, some people rebuilt part of it, but most of it was never rebuilt. So you have this destruction layer that no one churned up and recycled and destroyed with constant rebuilding and, you know, destruction. A preserved destruction layer from the time of David and Solomon, basically, that was untouched until our time. And that is unusual. And so you find more. And we found all sorts of stuff. You saw the picture of the weapons, you know, yesterday. But we found all sorts of stuff, and we could do two or three different lectures just on this one site. But to sum up what we learned about it, some features that are important. The houses here were attached to the city wall. In other places like the Philistines or the Canaanites or even the northern kingdom of Israel, you have a city wall, then you have like a street separating the wall from the private buildings, the houses. But here, that's not what we have. I'm sitting in the entrance to one of the casemates in this photo. And there's the outer wall back there. Here's the inner wall. And the divider is right here. And I'm sitting in a doorway. See these stones here? That's the wall of a house. The houses are built right up to the city wall, and they attach. And in fact, the room in here, the space between the city walls, is the room of a house. They used it as a dwell, like their den or something. And so that's a unique design. And you only find this design where the houses are attached, you know, the private buildings are attached to the public built, the wall, and even use the wall as a room for their house. That's only found in and around Judah's territory. You don't find it in the northern tribal territory. It's unique to the south, to the tribe of Judah. But where in the Bible did government first begin? In the north or the south? The south. Saul was a southern king. David's a southern king. Solomon's a southern king. After Solomon dies, they divide and they start developing a government in the north with different traditions and different, you know, approaches to things. Not just religiously, but the south had its own distinct architecture. Their cities, they had these casemate walls or later on solid walls, but the houses are attached to them. And that's different. Only around Judah do you have that. So they had their own central architect building things the same way, it seems. And this site has a central fortress. There's a later building on top of it from like 1,500 years later. But those walls marked there are the original fortress. You can see it's built on the bedrock. There's some central fortress there with thick walls, a government presence of some kind, administrative building perhaps. We also found an inscription. This is the inscription, actually, that got me over there. They discovered it the year before I went there, and I blogged about it, and someone saw my blog and invited me to join. But here's a drawing. It's the earliest possibly Hebrew inscription ever found, even older than the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's from David's time, 1,000 years B.C. The letters are not Hebrew letters as we know them. If you studied in the Hebrew, those letters look different. It's an earlier version of the alphabet. The letters are different shapes. Hebrew came from this alphabet. But the language appears to be Hebrew. There are some distinct Hebrew terms only found in Hebrew. It's very faded. You can't read all of it, even with high-tech scans. We can only make out parts of it. But parts of it have Hebrew words, so it appears to be a Hebrew inscription. And among the words, we have the word king and the word judge. Isn't that interesting? Of all the words to find, during the transition from the judges to the kings, we find those two words in this inscription from that time. We found another inscription on a jar, and it has a guy's name, Ishbael. It's a biblical name. King Saul had several sons. His last son had the same name, Ishbael. The Bible renames him Ishbosheth. He reigned for a brief period after Saul and his other sons died. Ishbosheth is a nickname. It means man of shame because he was an embarrassment. But it says in Chronicles, his real name was actually Ishbael, man of Baal. Saul named him. No surprised, are we? This is not the same God. They're not talking about Saul's son. It says Ishbael, son of someone else. But you have writing on a jar, which means someone could write it and someone else could read it. Evidence they could read and write their language. Literacy. And also, it's a jar that collected taxes. You pay taxes in your crops, a percentage of your crops. And so someone's collecting taxes and keeping records of taxes. That's a government thing, not a tribal thing. And so we see what we're getting from this. And this also shows the name Ishmael, we only find it in the Bible during the time of Saul and David. And we've only found this name in archaeology during the same time period. So it shows that name was in use in that time. We haven't found it later on in the Bible or in archaeology. So that kind of lines up. It's a snapshot into that period, isn't it? And these jars, we found several hundred of them. And they all have the same design. They're mass-produced jars for collecting taxes. And the handles have marks on them. Some have one little finger impression. Some have two, and some have three. Most of these only have one impression. Maybe all of them in this photo. No, a couple have two impressions. Near the bottom, there's one with two. But they're marking what's in the jar, it looks like. Maybe a single finger impression might mean olive oil. Two of them might mean some kind of grain. You know, and three might be something else. Someone's keeping track of things and keeping records of things. And we find this later in the kingdom of Judah also. How do we know these are tax collections and marking the what's in them for taxes? Because later on, in the time of Hezekiah and later kings, all the way up even into the Persian Empire, we have jars in Judah being marked on the handle, if they're government jars. Only government jars do this. The style changes, and some of them even have inscriptions, belongs to the king, government property, taxes. But even up, when you have other empires controlling the area, like the Persian Empire, in Judah, they still mark their tax jars with a stamp on the handle. And here are examples from different time periods. What we have at Caiapha, the finger impression, that's the earliest example of this. It's a Judah thing. They don't do this in the northern kingdom of Israel. They don't do this with the Philistines or the Canaanites or the Moabites or the Edomites. Only Judah does their jars this way. We have the earliest example of it. It started in the time of David, who built the government from the beginning. So it started then. Who lived there? It's on the border. Well, maybe the Philistines built the site. Maybe it wasn't David or a government. Maybe it was the Philistines. Well, the architectural style is only found in Judah, not Philistia. The storage jars have this tradition of stamping the handles. You only find that in Judah. The Philistines don't do it that way. I mentioned this in another lecture. Pig bones. There are none. We found thousands of animal bones here. None of them are pigs. And who does not eat pork? People under the covenant of Moses. The Philistines, they eat pigs. They eat pork. And so the inscription is in the Hebrew language, definitely not the Philistine language. It wasn't even a similar language. The Philistines had a very different one from Europe. And we looked, we found several religious spots on there, but none of them have idols or graven images, which it seems they're observing the commandment of Moses. Don't make any unto God any graven images. And so they're observing that to some degree. Everything points to Judah. So who built it and who lived there? Judah. It's the time of David. Whose government is it? Probably David. That's the only person, the only mention anywhere of whose government it might be in that period. So this site is the first evidence we've ever found of an emerging kingdom in the tribes, and it's down in Judah. We have planned cities. We have people marking the border. This site marks the border and fortifies it. Our territory, don't just walk on in. We have evidence of literacy, keeping records, writing. They could write stuff down after all. Evidence of central government in Judah in David's time for the first time. And so that's kind of special. So what happens to this gap? We now are filling it in with fresh information. We now have data, physical finds that point to a developing kingdom in the time when the Bible says it was happening. And so we're filling the gap. And that's a special thing. That's not the only one. There's a place, Kirbet al-Rai. That's an Arabic name that means ruin of the shepherd. And that's not a name we find in the Bible. It's a later name. But it's a site further down from Kirbet Caiapha, the one we've been talking about, also on the border of the Philistines, another border town. And I worked there in 2019 with a few other people. And it was originally a Philistine city that was destroyed and rebuilt as a city of Judah. So we see sort of a power shift on the border. Something that was Philistine, now it's Judah. So even just that right there reflects some changing politics, a growing kingdom that's superseding the Philistines. Here's the site After some of our excavations, here's me and the people that came over with me. My son Caleb is in the front row with the gray shirt and the hat. There's some other Christians that came. The guy in the back row with the hat, he's from California, Patterson, California, if any of you know where that is. He's actually been with me to dig three times. But that group went with me to dig. And in a nutshell, the site dates to the same time as the one we were talking about, Kibbutz Kayafa. The pottery is the same period, similar style, same fashion. So what do we have? We have another site, same time period, on the border. We have a network of border towns now. Not just one. We have at least two border towns marking the border during the time of David, and they look the same. So more evidence of a kingdom appearing there that's pushing back on the Philistines, defining itself against everyone else around them. And that sounds like what the Bible describes with David, doesn't it? How about Solomon? The Bible says he built a lot of stuff. In some ways, there's not as much with Solomon yet, because the best areas to dig for him in Jerusalem are Muslim holy areas. And you don't go tearing up Muslim holy areas to look for Jewish heritage. It just doesn't go well if you follow the politics at all. But here's the Bible says in 1 Kings 19, Solomon built the house of the Lord, the temple. We can't look there because that's on Muslim space now. We can't go looking for it. He built his own house, a new palace, that seems to have been in the same area covered now by Muslim buildings. The Milo, a fortification maybe, there's some debate on that, and the wall of Jerusalem. He built a new wall. And we think we found a section of his wall. This is a section of wall that dates to around Solomon's time. We found a 220-foot section of it so far. So it's significant. And so that appears to be part of the wall Solomon built. It also says he built three cities, Hazor or Hatzor, Megiddo, and Gezer. Not Gezer, Gezer. Gezer, we know what Gezer means. Gezer means carrot in Hebrew. Why would you name a city Carrot? I don't know. But we have some weird names here sometimes. There's a place near Tampa called Plant City. Okay, Gezer, Carrot. Anyway, but he says Solomon built all these places. These are known sites. We've excavated all of them. And here is the entrance and fortification for Hatzor, Hazor. It's up in the north above the Sea of Galilee. We have a casemate wall from the time of Solomon. And the entrance, we have these two towers in front of the gates. And when you go in the gate, you have these three chambers on each side. As you walk in, three chambers on each side, six in all. That's the plan for Hatzor. You go to Megiddo, also built by Solomon. And this picture's from this previous year. Eric, is that you in the background? Maybe with the hat? I can't tell. Anyway, this is us. That's Hatzor. That's us walking into the gate at Hatzor, Hazor. Solomon probably walked into this gate for an inspection tour when he built it. And so you can walk through the very steps where Solomon and other kings would have walked as well. Solomon's the northern kings. This is up north. Now, here's Megiddo. Solomon built this too, and this is part of the gate. You see three of the chambers. You walked in from the far side and walked in. Here's a gate. Here's a picture from this past trip I took in May. Archaeologists had torn out that side of the gate a long time ago to see what was under it, and now they've rebuilt it so we can see what it would have looked like originally. This is the view as you walk in. The left side, that's original stone. Those wooden beams, though, below that's original. Above, it's reconstructed. But this is the view walking into Solomon's gate. And it has three chambers on each side. The same design. The same architect. And then what's the third city? Gezer. This is a view. And we see looking, coming in from the outside in, three chambers on each side. The same design. All three of the city gates, says Solomon built, had the same architecture, the same blueprint. What does it indicate? Same architect, same central government. That's evidence of the same builder, which is what we'd expect to find. And so there's that for Solomon. And how about the early divided kingdom? Who is Solomon's son? Rehoboam. And it says that he had to rebuild defenses after some problems. And one of the cities he built for defense is Lachish or Lachish. And we talked about this some, I think, yesterday. Here's the site. But our expedition in 2017 found Rehoboam's fortification wall that it's referencing in that text. It's a 10-foot thick solid wall, not casemate this time. They had more resources. They had more people. So it, instead of a quick casemate wall thrown together faster, it's a 10-foot thick solid wall. And people had dug there before, never found it. We did. And there it is. And it dates solidly to Rehoboam's time, around 920 BC, which is Rehoboam's time. It dates solidly to that. And so we have evidence of something the Bible says would be there, and we found what we expected to find. Here's that section with other walls, in fact, because this is an example of a tell. All these different destroyed cities over time going up and up and up. And if we look down here, this city wall, that's the time of Abraham. The city was around as a Canaanite city in Abraham's time. It was destroyed. Level 6 is some unwalled town. They built some things, but no fortifications. Then we have no fortifications. Maybe that's why Rehoboam had to build it for defense, because it didn't have any fortifications. Maybe they hadn't needed them in Solomon's time. But here's the wall Rehoboam built, this whole stretch going across, the one the Bible mentions. You go up to later kings, and you have a mud brick wall from Hezekiah's time, a wall the Babylonians built when they took over management, a wall the Persians built in the time of Nehemiah, because they used the site, and they had to rebuild defenses. So the fifth level down is the one with Rehoboam, and we found his fortification wall, which the Bible says should be there, and we found it. So again, this gap, we now have, just in the past 17 years, fresh evidence that has filled it. And so it's completely changed the understanding of the period and changed the debates over it. And that's a blessing. And it's evidence that the Bible, when it talks about these things, it's getting them right. We can find, when we think about what we really should expect to find in the areas where we're able to dig, we're finding it. And that's faith building, among other things. Let's go later, though, because later kings are also descendants of David. Hezekiah, the Bible says he was a righteous king. He removed the high places. We talked about this yesterday. There was a high place in the gate of Lachish. It was a small temple, you know, with a restricted entrance and a holy place and the most holy place. And we found the same layout in miniature in the gate, a high place to worship going in and out of the city. And in the high place, we found it was destroyed in the time of Hezekiah. And we found a toilet in there, which sounds weird, but about a century or more earlier, another king named Jehu up north eradicated the Baal idol. And when he destroyed the temple of Baal, he turned it into a latrine, to a bathroom. And so it appears Hezekiah's people did the same thing with this high place. They destroyed it, put a toilet in there. Same concept. And now we've attested it archaeologically. We also have another outside wall Hezekiah built around Jerusalem. We talked about that yesterday. And there it is. And there it is. We dug a section of it up. And it's going on. We talked about that. I also want to talk about that little pool. Right there, zoom in a little bit. Hezekiah built that. The Bible said, what's that pool do? Why is it special? Hezekiah, in 2 Chronicles 32, he closed the outlet to the waters of Gihon and directed them to the west side of the city of David. Jerusalem's water supply up till Hezekiah's time was on the right side. It was a spring on the hill outside the walls usually. And people had dug tunnels to get to it underground, and other periods built the wall down around it, but it was always vulnerable. And so, is it the final bell or the next to last? Fun. Okay, well, I'm just about done. So, okay. Anyway, that blue line, Hezekiah decided to strengthen his defenses to make sure the enemy couldn't get the water also. He dug a tunnel on the course of that blue line, blocked up the spring, permanently blocked it up and disguised it so no one could see where it was, and made it flow. Instead of flowing out the side of the hill, it flowed through this tunnel to a pool he built inside the city and then built a new wall around it. So now he secures the water. It stays inside. Someone attacking the city cannot have the possibility of taking the water supply. And that's quite a project. And we found his tunnel. It's Hezekiah's tunnel. This is it. And the water still flows through it today, and visitors to Jerusalem can walk through it today. It's a third of a mile long. Eric and Cindy both walked through it, didn't you? If you don't want to do it, you can take an optional route around it. But most people walk through it. The water still flows, but that's Hezekiah's tunnel. And the Bible describes that he made it, and we have it. And that's one of David's descendants. Big footprint there. Quickly, the Assyrians attacked Hezekiah. The Assyrians king's name was Sennacherib, and the Bible talks about it in several different places. And it says that he took all these cities, and this cylinder is Sennacherib's own record of his military campaign into Judah. And he describes all the cities he took and lists all the captives and spoil from each city. The Bible describes this attack. It says he came to Jerusalem, and an angel destroyed a lot of Sennacherib's army, and Sennacherib left. So how does Sennacherib record that? Well, you don't want to look weak. So he wrote on there, "I trapped Hezekiah in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage." Ha, 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 ha. And we're done. He doesn't talk about capturing it, doesn't talk about the captives and spoil he took when he captured it. By his omission, he confirms what the Bible says. He didn't take the city. And so even in his own way, he it confirms the Bible. Well, that's it for the class period. I guess you're out of time. But we may have time for questions and answers later tonight after the final session. If you have a question about this, you can ask me today if there's a chance. If not, work it in this evening after our final session. Thank you so much.